Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. I'm Captain Ed Garibay. In today's podcast, we'll be talking about Army Watercraft Systems, the Army's Navy. It may come to a surprise to some, but the Army has boats. The Army has actually been using watercraft in combat since the Revolutionary War. Just think of any picture or painting you've ever seen of Washington crossing the Delaware, or the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, or the Battle of Hue in Vietnam. Army watercraft were there, either independently or as part of a joint force. Today, the Army continues to employ watercraft, including the Logistics Support Vessel, LSV, Landing Craft Utility, LCU, Landing Craft Mechanized, LCM, and a variety of floating utility crafts such as floating causeways that are all a part of the Transportation Corps. Here to discuss Army watercraft operations and their role in maritime sustainment is Brigadier General Beth Bain, the 33rd Chief of Transportation for the United States Army, and Colonel Retired Rich Creed, Director of the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate, or CAD. Ma'am, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ed. Great to be here.
Sir, welcome back.
Good to be here, Ed. Thanks.
So, ma'am, as the Chief of Transportation, obviously you're an authority on this subject, Army Watercraft Systems, but it's my understanding that you also have a long personal history in Army Watercraft. Is that right?
It's true. I count myself as very fortunate. So I branched transportation when I was commissioned in 1994, and my first duty assignment was with the 7th Transportation Group at the time at Fort Eustis, Virginia, and I was a boat platoon leader. I did all of my lieutenant assignments in terminal battalions, two different watercraft units, and then port operations units, crane detachments, cargo documentation. So I cut my teeth around Army watercraft, graduated from the officer basic course, and deployed immediately to Haiti with my boat platoon, did Operation Uphold Democracy, doing resupply and humanitarian aid missions all around the coast of Haiti. Great early opportunity, you know, sort of sink or swim, literally, as the case may be. So I learned a lot. I count myself fortunate to have been raised by Army mariners and to have had those early experiences. And then I went off and did mainstream Army transportation stuff, commanded a truck company, and then did multifunctional assignments in BSBs in both 2nd and 3rd Infantry Division. And then again, I was really fortunate to have the chance to come back and command the 7th Transportation Brigade Expeditionary. And so kind of a homecoming back to my roots in many ways. Had the privilege of leading that brigade from 2017 to 19. And then later became the Chief of Transportation. So here I am when I was a lieutenant in Haiti in 1995. They used to say, "Where's the boat lady? We need we need watercraft or something." And I feel like sometimes when I walk around the Pentagon, people say, "Aren't you the boat lady?" So it's sort of a moniker I haven't been able to shake. But it's been a joy to be around this field. And I'm excited about a lot of the things that are on the horizon right now for Army watercraft.
That's when I met you, was when you were the
7th TBX. So
the 7th, yep.
You were right. On the roadshow for FM-30.
And we were doing TTXs on the new FM-40.
That's right.
And you were one that was trying to make us smart about watercraft even back then.
Doing my best, you know? Yeah.
So you probably get this question a lot then, ma'am, is why does the Army have boats?
Yeah, great question. I do get that question a lot. In fact, we have a briefing slide that we use for a lot of engagements called Why Army Watercraft. And I guess first and foremost, because it's the law, the Army has Title 10 responsibilities to do campaign shaping in competition and crisis. And the Army has a specific task to provide watercraft support specifically for intra-theater transportation in a theater of operations. So, you know, a common misunderstanding often is that Army watercraft are the strategic vessels, those large LMSR that we use to deploy for inter-theater. Army watercraft are capable of inter-theater movement, but they're really designed for intra-theater movement. So, you know, taking equipment that's been delivered into a theater from a strategic vessel And then doing intra-theater movement of either that equipment or sustainment stocks. So so the Army's got a Title 10 responsibility, and watercraft have a role in that. And then we've got requirements from the Joint Force. So the Army provides a support to joint logistics over the shore. So think of times when there is not a port with deep draft vessel capability. We can't bring one of our large vessels in, either because the port just doesn't have that capability, or that port's being denied, or it's been degraded. And so we got to find alternative ways to get over the shore, right? And that's what joint logistics over the shore can do for you. So downloading of a strategic vessel onto Army and Navy lighterage, small craft, landing craft that can then either drop a ramp onto a beach and move equipment directly over a beach that way, or come into an unimproved port with their low draft, drop their ramp on an unimproved port, or use the modular causeway system or the Navy's equivalent of that to get into areas that strategic vessels just can't reach.
How are these different, though, than, say, like what the Navy has? Or how are our vessels kind of different, or even our mission
in yeah.
what we're doing?
So in general, you know, the Navy is the big blue ocean, and the Army is operating in that littoral space, what you know, the Navy often calls brown water areas. And so the Army and Navy have overlap, and we have complementing equipment sets. But the Navy's primary focus is that big blue, large ocean-going mission, and they've got clear, you know, Title 10 and DoD responsibilities that have been specified to them. We work very closely with the Navy. They have beach handling units that are complementary to our capabilities. You know, one of the best examples of this is going on right now is the humanitarian mission that's getting ready to get underway in Gaza. So that will be a combination of Army and Navy capabilities coming together to construct a pier off of the beach in Gaza and move humanitarian aid across that from strategic vessels using Army and Navy assets to deliver that humanitarian aid.
So from a doctrinal standpoint, where do Army watercraft fit into the larger Army enterprise?
Well, I mean, there's a historical record, and as Sherman Baden said, that historical record is a little bit mixed, right? I mean, you go back to the Revolutionary War and you talk about that, but it wasn't the Navy providing boats. It was the Army going and foraging to collect boats and finding volunteers to row people across rivers during those campaigns. But in the Second World War, we published a book in 1944, so about 6 months before D-Day, called FM 55-130, Small Boats and Harbor Craft, which was probably pretty timely, given that the largest logistics over the shore operation of World War II, probably forever, was to support, you know, the operations in Normandy and the breakout from Normandy, because we didn't have access to any of the other channel ports. So, I mean, all of our logistics were coming over the shore in some relatively small places, but a pretty impressive standpoint. We've got the FM 415 Army watercraft operations now. General Bates probably had more than just a little bit of her hand in that. And we were helping as best we could, not just with the doctrine, but to kind of get the word out in terms of situational awareness with Army senior leaders, since we participate in things other than doctrine writing exercises. We kind of wanted to carry the water a little bit, not to use a pun, but spread the word that this is important stuff, right? It was only a few years ago that we were making force structure decisions in the Army about port opening detachments and some of these other things that are very closely related to this capability. And there were people that said, hey, it's low risk to do away with some of these discrete, very small units, all because mostly they're not on active duty, and who's going to notice and all that, because they didn't understand how we wanted to fight. And so this brings you into the current era where We're not just looking at the Army conducting operations in traditional land theaters like the CENTCOM area of operations or in Europe, or even just on the Korean Peninsula. Not that there wouldn't have been a lot of, Army watercraft involved in operations on the Korean Peninsula, but really when you get into the Western Pacific and some of these other areas, whether you're talking about the Philippines or the First and Second Island Chain, or parts of Japan. If we are serious about a Pacific pivot that the U.S. Department of Defense said we were doing in 2011, and you believe that land forces have a role to play in a theater like Indo-PACOM, as the United States Army not only believes but knows to be true, then Army watercraft are really important. And I will tell you, when I was at TRADOC headquarters, when I first came to TRADOC, you were in meetings where Army senior leaders were talking about, hey, are we going to modernize Army watercraft or not? And people would come and make, your predecessor came in and made a passion plea that, hey, sir, you know, some of this stuff's 40, 50, maybe even older in terms of years. And people were agonizing over whether we were just going to buy a couple of boats or not. But they were at least taking it seriously. But, I mean, I don't think we've got the impetus towards really taking it seriously to the last few years, Matt.
Yeah. And so, you know, if I can just dovetail on some of that, the deep history is, you know, the Revolutionary War. The more near-term history is the Army came very close to completely divesting of watercraft in the 2018-19 timeframe. Tough decisions. Army was making tough decisions on a lot of programs. And, you know, kind of going back to the difference between the Army and the Navy, at one point the Army reached out to the Navy and said, hey, we're about to get rid of this capability altogether, heads up. And the Navy came back and said, slow your roll, Army. If you think we're going to pick all of that up, you got another thing coming for you. And so, sort of the combination of inter-service discussions, the simultaneous pivot to the Pacific, identification of Indo-PACOM as our pacing theater, and some intense congressional interest, I think, caused the Army to pause, relook, and produce a transformation strategy that said, we're going to divest in order to invest. So we went from about 132 systems down to 70 platforms. And took all of our watercraft out of the reserve component. So all of our craft and crews are now in the active component. Repositioned some of those forces into the Pacific, and then took the cost savings from divestment to invest into modernizing the fleet. And so that's the road that we've been on, divest to invest. Improve the readiness of the current fleet while we develop and field new systems for the environment that we think we're gonna face in our pacing theater.
You know, ma'am, the other thing is it's not just about Indo-PACOM, right? I mean, first time I even thought about Army watercraft, I was riding on a flight out of Kuwait on R&R.
Sure.
Right, and I'm sitting next to this guy, and he kind of had long hair, but he was a fit-looking fella. And he was very chatty, and he starts talking to me, and he says, I'm a chief warrant officer. And I said, oh, good to meet you, chief. And I, what do you do? So I do Army watercraft. He's a captain of one of the watercraft. I said, well, what are you doing here, right? And lo and behold, there was a significant, throughout our time in Iraq, Army watercraft effort doing essentially logistics.
Absolutely.
Back and forth. He had some pretty hair-raising stories about some pretty crazy things going on that, I mean, I don't think any of them ever made the newspaper or anything else. Really interesting.
Right. I mean, you would laugh about sea stories, but, you know, you get some crusty Army mariners around who operated in CENTCOM in those days, and they've definitely got some stories to tell. You mentioned the operations in CENTCOM. We had a long-standing presence there. When we did that divestment decision, we took everything out of CENTCOM, and so all of our watercraft are now positioned between Fort Eustis, Virginia, with the 7th TBX, and then forward in Hawaii, and now, as of this past year, in Japan. So we just activated a composite watercraft company in Japan in February. Breaking news here on Breaking Doctor. So, you know, hopefully you saw something in the news about that, because it was pretty big news. But that composite watercraft company is, you know, a clear indicator of how we're continuing to reposition forces to be in the position we need to be in our pacing theater to contribute to the integrated deterrence that the National Defense Strategy talks to. And Army Watercraft can play a pretty significant role in that. I have to give huge credit to USRPAC and 8th TSC and Major General Helwig in particular. General Helwig has been pushing the envelope in employing Army Watercraft in Pacific Pathways. So Talisman Sabre this past summer, significant role for Army Watercraft, conducted a JLOTS off the coast of Australia, you know, partnered with the Australians, who also have a watercraft capability, something that we're continuing to try to develop that relationship. And our Japanese partners are also looking at developing a capability. So lots of options for working with allies and partners in our pacing theater, again, to be part of that coordinated effort on integrated deterrence.
And when you're talking about these different exercises, ma'am, and obviously using these different types of capabilities, JLOTS or any kind of watercraft, how's that affecting the exercise, and how does that affect the commander that is there doing the exercise? What do they need to be keeping in the back of their head when they're doing this, and how this kind of changes and shapes the way they should be thinking about how operations are?
So one of the things that our Army Watercraft Modernization Strategy, which is in draft form right now, in review by Army senior leaders. But one of the things that it calls for is doing a better job of educating our maneuver leaders on the capabilities of Army Watercraft and the employment opportunities. So think of rapid repositioning of that capability to reach a position of relative advantage, and then repositioning of that kind of capability as well, either from one island to another or from one part of an island to another. Again, I think back to all of the repositioning that we did around the coast of Haiti, in my early days. Watercraft can do resupply of forces that have been positioned forward. They can be used for CASAVAC as well and backhaul. They open up opportunities and options. So we all know commanders like options. Army Watercraft gives commanders options and flexibility in a maritime environment.
It's the only way you can move mass, right, ma'am? Any plan that assumes that we're going to have a significant Air Force airlift support is probably not a wise move. The Air Force is going to be pretty busy. There may be a lot of other things going on than trying to support just the plane movement, which is fundamental to maneuver in those archipelagos or in littorals. But it's the mass piece that I think watercraft give you that aircraft do not, right? So, but I think it's an education piece too, right? Because you have to train that. And then, I mean, there are some things that are very different about it.
Yeah, for sure. And we're learning all the time. We're learning through our actual exercises, and then we're learning through our modeling and simulation. The Army Futures Command Future Studies Program that's been going on this past year, in FSP 24-1, they specifically looked at a maritime environment, and they modeled some different things that we've looked at for watercraft formations that don't currently exist, but that we can envision, right? So think of a watercraft battalion that's equipped with autonomous heavy lift capabilities, operating in outside of second island chain, but moving from one theater distribution center to another, or moving stocks forward out of a theater distribution center, you know, into an area where forces have been positioned or repositioned. So we modeled that. We modeled what craft that are modernized for better speed, protection, C5ISR, and some really interesting results from that that have shaped our ongoing work in modernizing the fleet. I'll tell you, the pathway that we're on right now is to field 13 maneuver support vessel light. And so that will replace our Mike boats. Now, some of the Mike boats are older than I am, and that's pretty old, right? So they were originally constructed in the late 60s and early 70s. So I know how I feel when I get up in the morning. I can only imagine what a Mike boat feels like trying to get fired up. So we're replacing our oldest and least capable craft first, and that's the maneuver support vessel light is the solution to that small craft set. The difference between a Mike boat and an MSV light is like getting out of a horse and buggy and into a Trans Am. You know, our mariners who've been testing the prototype can't say enough about the difference in handling with a craft that has that kind of speed. Why does that matter so much? We're thinking about taking advantage of windows of opportunity, pulsed protection windows. That's where a vessel with that kind of speed, that's also got both active and passive defense measures an improved maintenance system that's leveraging predictive logistics sensors that are built into the engineering of the vessel in a way that couldn't have even been imagined when the Mike boats were constructed in the late 60s. That's where we really begin to see in our modeling the positive dividends of a modernized fleet. So maneuver support vessel light to replace the Mike boat. And then we have our medium and heavy lift space that we also know is in need of modernization. And that's where we're looking at a number of different options. So the potential to contract commercial vessels and then make slight modifications to those. The Marine Corps have done that. They contracted for a commercial vessel and added a stern ramp to it. So they're calling it the stern landing vessel. They demonstrated that out at Project Convergence. Again, back to the Pacific, Major General Helwig with 8th TSC, they've contracted for a commercial vessel to use during Pacific Pathways exercises this summer and in the summer of 24. So we'll learn a lot from that. We're beginning to see that a cost-effective, readily available fleet of commercial vessels are out there that could be put to our purposes. So we're looking at contract vessels. You mentioned Washington crossing the Delaware, right? I mean, you know, the Continental Army just went out and found fishermen and, small boat operators and said, get us across the river. So kind of living up to that same tradition. We're also looking really hard at autonomous capabilities. I mentioned the autonomous heavy lift vessels that we're exploring, but the contested logistics cross-functional team is specifically exploring an autonomous resupply vessel. The Navy and the Marine Corps have partnered and are experimenting with a very small capacity vessel. So we want to build on the work that they've done. We think we need something with more mass, right? Mm-hmm. The ability to deliver more. But that technology is out there. Again, the commercial sector is already using autonomous vessels. And so that's another area that we're recommending for investment and research. And then the third is, you know, back to partnering with our joint brothers and sisters. The Navy is developing a vessel called the Landing Ship Medium. It's got similar capabilities that the Army is looking for our heavy lift capability. In any cases, it's ripe for collaboration. We're already meeting on a regular basis with our joint partners to look at ways that we can potentially jointly develop a vessel that meets both services' needs. So contracting commercial vessels, exploring the full range of opportunities with autonomous craft, and then opportunities to partner with the joint team. Those are kind of the directions that we're headed beyond the maneuver support vessel light.
You know, those economies of scale, I think, could be a real big deal.
Right.
because the Marines have a different operational concept than us with this whole advanced expeditionary basing operations and these littoral combat regiments. And they divested themselves of their armor. And, I don't know, about half their artillery. But they're looking, they call themselves the stand-in forces.
Stand-in force.
Well, we're the stand-on force.
And the stand-in force will get hungry and thirsty, and they'll eat a lot of things that I envision the Army. That's what we do. We help sustain that stand-in force. And Army Watercraft won't be the single solution to anything, right? That's an incredibly complex theater to think about operating in, and when we've got an adversary with the range and the magazine depth. That we know we'll face in that theater, it's going to take every solution. So I go back to options. I mean, the Air Force is going to be able to meet part of the intra-theater lift requirements, the Navy and the Marine Corps are part of that, but the Army will have a significant role in that too, and that's where our Army watercraft fleet can really contribute to the fight.
That Army support to other services, we may find ourselves, you know, the Air Force working off their lily pads. I can see team transportation, watercraft, moving a lot of fuel.
Right.
And that kind of stuff around.
Runway repair kits.
Yes, ma'am.
Those are another thing. Bulldozers.
So I heard you say a couple times, quite a number of times, you're talking contested. And for the last couple of decades, we've been doing uncontested for the most part. As we're doing global war on terror, as we kind of shift this focus, and you know, FM30 has an entire maritime domain chapter in which we're talking about how we face the enemy threat. And so, what are the different things that we're looking at when we're talking about a contested versus an uncontested maritime domain?
Well, maybe first we have to define the maritime domain, because we get into trouble sometimes. USERPAC and General Flynn reminds us. Certainly, hey, Indo-PACOM is a joint theater. It's not a maritime theater. It's not an air theater. It's a joint theater, right? And we're in violent agreement. We're the biggest cheerleaders in that regard. But when you talk about a maritime domain, the maritime domain encompasses all the islands, all the littoral regions, the archipelagos, and the coastlines, right? All the places where land forces have to operate. And you're not fighting over the water, and you're not fighting over the air. You're fighting over the control of resources and people. And oh, by the way, we've got in that theater in particular, I believe 5 of our 6 go to war allies are there. And they all live on land. They're not out there treading water in the middle of the Western Pacific. So I think the first part of addressing the problem is recognizing the reality that land forces have a role to play, not just for securing land, but for also enabling the other services there. You can do a lot from land to ensure freedom of action in the air and maritime domains. And so the rest of the Army is working on that. But sustaining that effort is not an airlift only solution. It gets back to your point, ma'am, about, hey, it's a joint solution and it's a multifaceted solution. And we can contract some things. But, I mean, there is a reality of the U.S. Merchant Marine is rather thin these days. And so, you know, getting a foreign armed companies to loan us their stuff, I guess if you pay enough money, they'll do that. But then where do the crews come from and so forth?
Yeah, two things come to mind for me immediately when we talk about contested logistics and the intersection with what we're doing with Army Watercraft. One is, in study after study, is going to limit the distance. It's going to change what we used to call intra-theater versus inter-theater. So inter-theater, you know, we were really fortunate to be able to bring everything we wanted into Kuwait and build it up and then move it forward however we wanted to, or name your staging base in Europe or any other theater. We know that we will not have that luxury in future conflicts. So, you know, if the limit to which strategic vessels filled with a brigade combat team's worth of equipment, if they have to download that further back, then the distance that is now considered intra-theater lift just grew fairly significantly. And within that intra-theater movement zone, we can be, you know, it's a transparent battlefield. So anything that is moving can be seen, and if you can be seen, you can be targeted. So it drives the discussion of what are the growing intra-theater lift requirements based on the fact that there's high risk of bringing strategic vessels into that zone. What does that mean for intra-theater lift requirements? And then who's going to move that stuff and by what means? And then within moving it, how do we ensure that our intra-theater lift assets have the right active and passive defense measures, that they're tied in through a C5ISR network with the protection folks? I think regardless of what theater you look at right now, MDO says that protection and sustainment have a new and deeper relationship than ever before. Now, we're seeing that play out in CTC rotations and in warfighters, in some cases, sustainment drives the protection requirements, and at other times, you know, protection is going to drive the sustainment plan, but the two have an absolutely integral relationship with one another. So, you know, those are the two things for me that immediately come to mind when we start talking contested logistics and Army watercraft.
So it's an enabler of both endurance and depth.
Absolutely.
And one of the things I see, too, when we're talking about contested, is the reason, even beyond the contested of the watercraft, and that the reason we need JLOTs or anything is because it is contested. We may not have those ship ports to go into. And so RSO and I are is a big part of the reason we needed for MDO. And, you know, Normandy even was for JLOTs to move the things in there. What's kind of that role of RSO and I?
I mean, if I wanted to contest the United States, my first and foremost objective would be to prevent us from getting to the fight. Because once we get there, we're pretty darn good. You better bring your lunch, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's why I think we need to think hard and we've got to think through, again, protection networks. So how do we flow capabilities into a theater to ensure the adequate protection to allow the rest of the capability to flow in, knowing that stopping us from getting to the fight will be any would-be adversary's top objective. So again, you know, kind of goes back to options, and those ports are degraded. Somehow we still got to get to the fight. And so, you know, watercraft are a part of the potential solution for that dilemma.
One of the things we had talked about, and you were there for the Army Strategic Education Program Command discussions with the flag officers last year, man, was we talk about RSOI. So for the listeners, it's reception, staging, onward movement, and integration. But when we talked about what you meant earlier with this extension of what or the expansion of what intra-theater is, right? Well, I can't move as deep into it as I could before because of the threat. We had talked about this idea, maybe in some cases you have to reorder the letters, so it's reception, staging, integration someplace, because the last step is onward move. And to your point, Army watercraft play a role in that, particularly when it comes to mass.
Right. I think about, I was in Kuwait for Desert Thunder in 1998, and elements of the 3rd Infantry Division flowed in as a deterrence effort to what we thought could be another round of Iraq invading Kuwait. And we drew stuff out of APS, 3rd Infantry flowed in, some stuff came by sea, some stuff came by air. And then we sat there in Kuwait and configured it all for combat, right? Put the radios in, did all of that integration, assembled it into unit formations, and then moved out to tactical assembly areas. And to Mr. Creed's point, I don't know that we'll have that luxury. And so that integration may need to happen further back. It may even need to happen in CONUS, right? So, you know, something that we talk about with SDDC often is, if we're going to need to flow into theater already configured, do we Right. Currently, we load vessels for efficiency, right, to get the max. But maybe we need to load vessels for being ready to roll off and roll right onto, right into an area of operation. We're onto a lift asset, could be Army watercraft, that then move it forward into a tactical assembly area. So that integration could happen back in CONUS, could happen at a node in theater outside of the A2AD reach.
What about the different theaters? I mean, we're talking about watercraft, and we talked a lot about, the Pacific and the Pacific pivot. But there will need to be Army watercraft in all different types of theaters. So obviously we use it within CENTCOM. We have the Pacific. There's also the European theater, the domestic, sure, and even the Arctic theater. And there's a number of different things. Is there a significant difference in how we approach each of these different regions?
There's absolutely different geographic considerations. The basic capabilities, I think, remain the same, but there's nuances in each theater. So, in Europe, I don't think I mentioned this previously, but one of the other roles of Army watercraft is inland waterways. So movements, out of littoral spaces into inland waterways, and so Europe is lots of inland waterways. If you look at current events, again, the Black Sea is a beehive of activity where you can envision roles for Army watercraft. The Arctic poses some special challenges. So we've done JLOTs up in Alaska, I think 2016 most recently. We've also used the Army Causeway system down in Antarctica to help create when the ice bridge melts and you still need to resupply our scientists that are working down there. The Army Causeway system has done two different support operations down there. But definitely some different considerations when you think about operating in that Arctic environment and being rated for those sorts of temperatures, the ice obstacles in the water.
Yeah, ma'am, I think one of the things I was thinking about is, the Russians are actually, all of the sustainment that comes to the forces in the southern part of Ukraine through Crimea, they're very nervous about using the bridge, the Kerch Bridge, because the Ukrainians have targeted several times, which is why the Ukrainians have been trying to deny and sink multiple Russian vehicles. And while they've targeted warships, they've really gone after their LST equivalents, right, or their amphibs, trying to sink those because that's really a way to create depth for the defending force and really kind of chop the logistics legs out from the Russians. So it makes you think, okay, well, if that's the dynamic that's happening here, and granted, it's a smaller geographical place, what do we anticipate a threat trying to do to us?
Right.
I think in some ways it might be easier to kind of to interdict our strategic lines of communication in a place as vast as, say, the Pacific or the Atlantic Oceans, but in some ways it might be more difficult, right?
Right.
So there may be opportunities in terms of being able to conceal what we're trying to do to present ourselves as less than lucrative targets.
All right. I think, oftentimes we talk in the land domain about deception and cover and concealment, but there's aspects of that that are equally applicable in a maritime environment. And so again, we do a lot of work with the Navy. We train with the Navy. We coordinate with the Navy about what those protection networks could be, ways that we could contribute to them, as a forward sensor relaying information back, as well as benefit from some of the Navy's capabilities. That we're under no illusion, the Army, that is, that the Navy is going to routinely dedicate, escort vessels for Army watercraft. But I also think, as a joint force, there will be times where the priority, the main effort may be sustainment of a forward employed capability. And so maybe the sustainment is going to be traveling via Army watercraft, and that becomes, for the JTF commander, the number one asset to be protected. So again, that connection between a movement working board and a protection working board. Those two, in my mind, have to be more closely linked than ever before, whether you're talking really land or maritime operations.
You know, you had mentioned, ma'am, about riverine operations or inland waterway operations, and this is kind of one of those skill sets, too, that had kind of gone away. I know in the Cold War days, the Northern Warfare Training Center used to do annual riverine schoolhouse classes to teach people how to do this. And so, and in like the Battle of Hue in Vietnam, supplies came through the river to Hue, and that's how they did that. And so there's a lot of value to this type of skill set. Do you see a future in this? What's the future of inland waterways and riverine operations?
Well, we continue to train our mariners on inland waterway and riverine operations. It's a core task for Army mariners, and designing our craft in a way that they can both perform that broader intra-theater movement, but also conduct operations in inland waterways. I think there's potential for autonomous capabilities to operate in those sorts of spaces and effectively. So we're researching that as well.
So ma'am, we've talked about watercraft, we've talked about doctrine, we've talked about large scale combat operations, but I want a moment to talk about the Army sailor and what that takes, because my understanding, there's quite a bit of training. They are doing all of the training relevant to have professional certifications in that type of thing. So, well, what does it take to be an Army sailor?
I'm so glad that you asked. I'm always happy to brag about Army mariners, because they're a special group of soldiers. They're soldiers first, and then they've got this unique capability and training that allows them to operate very complex craft. One of the things that is really different between the Navy and Army is our model for mariners. So the Navy will have many, many different specialties operating in the engineering room of a vessel. They'll have somebody who specializes in HVAC repair, somebody specializing in electronics, somebody who specializes in fuel systems. For the Army, it's all one. We have one watercraft engineer MOS, it's 88 Limas, and one warrant officer specialty, 881s. So we're a jack of all trades. On our deck side, our watercraft operators, those are 88 kilos, and the warrant officer specialty in that field is an 880. Our deck warrant officers are the captains of the vessel. I think Rich mentioned that earlier. So they are, for our LSV detachments, they are both a detachment commander with AR-600-20 authority. They're the captain of a large vessel, and they are, they are the senior mariner on that vessel as well. So tremendous amount of responsibility when you are haze gray and underway. That's all you got is the crew that you have. So every member of the crew is certified in firefighting, because you're alone and unafraid. You can't call 911 and get the fire department out there. So they're all certified in firefighting. They're all certified in damage control. So think of something damaging the hull and the vessel taking on water. We train in damage control tanks where you're feeling the water rise and using every material available. It's an exciting training event for our mariners, as is the firefighting. I mean, we have a pretty amazing firefighting simulator, fills with smoke. There's somebody down in the engine room, and you can't see anything, and you can't breathe, and you got 2 minutes to get your gear on and get down there and extinguish the fire and find the individual. So I'm super proud of what our mariners do. It's a high op tempo field, small, in high demand, and oftentimes on extensive missions. Just an example, the 7th CBX sits in 18th Airborne Corps for good reason, right? It's an Army capability, rapid response for any contingency around the world. It's a one of its kind in the active component. We have one TBX in the reserve component, one TBX headquarters, but the 7th TBX with its current fleet is the rapid response for anywhere in the world.
And correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't the Army also operate the ports when we're talking about different regions where the Navy goes into, and we have Army mariners there helping bring the vessels in?
So we have we have the potential, absolutely, and the capability to do port opening and port operations. So we do that through our terminal battalions. Again, exciting news here on Breaking Doctrine. We are about to activate a terminal battalion in Japan. What do terminal battalions do? They mission command Army watercraft units, but also inland cargo transportation companies and seaport operations companies, harbor master detachments, so that, again, you can move into an unimproved port, a degraded port, a port that once had civilians operating it, but for whatever reason, they're not there anymore. And we can fall in with that terminal battalion. We can operate the cranes. We can control the flow of vessels in and out. We can partner with Army divers who are part of our engineer corps to find any obstacles, submerged obstacles in and around that port, and do surveys to determine which craft are able to come in there. So it's a great capability. It's one that is prominent in many of our plans for all of our theaters, is to employ terminal battalions.
Well, ma'am, thank you for joining us on the show, sir. Again, any final parting thoughts as we close out here?
No, I just think we have to do a better job of communicating the importance and the necessity, right? Because everything's a compete for resources, and the Army is not getting bigger. But if there's things that we have to do, we had a conversation just a couple weeks ago with some people, and the realization was, and it was done in a humorous way, but the Army is the only service that when the other services decide they're not going to do something, then the Army has to do it. We're the jack of all trades. I mean, we are. And I think sometimes people forget that. That there's a reason why we have these organizations, large and small, and they seem very exotic in some senses, but there's a reason why we have them. And sometimes we just have to remind people why we have them, because they may not be important for a decade or so, and then all of a sudden, they're the most important thing that we have to worry about. So,
yeah, I would highlight there is keen Army senior leader interest in what the capabilities are in Army watercraft, and clear agreement on the idea that it's a capability that we need. So we have a commitment to modernize the Army watercraft fleet, a commitment to explore every opportunity to partner with not just the other services, but with our allies and partners as well. And we're moving out on that in a number of different ways. So I'm just excited to be part of the field at this particular time. I'm super proud of our Army mariners that are out there every day, contributing to integrated deterrence and competition, supporting current operations, and I'm excited about where the field is headed.
Awesome. Ma'am, sir, thanks for the great conversation, and thanks for being part of Breaking Doctrine.
Thanks for letting us be here.
Thanks, Ed.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, Breaking Doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Our executive producer is Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by 29 Pixel Studios. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or Audible Podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, the Combined Arms Support Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Captain Ed Garibay, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.